and gentlemen. Welcome to House Committee on Health and Human Services. This is the 28th.
Last
day of the month of February. We welcome you today. It's 9:15, the appointed time for us to begin. We'll start this morning by having an informational hearing and update, and we welcome and we're honored to have Director Max Williams, Director of Corrections for the State of Oregon. Max, would you and Claudia like to come forward? Please. Okay, and Cindy Duran, let's see, is Claudia, well, whomever. You introduce the table, please, Director Williams. Again, we're honored to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It is very much my pleasure to be with you early on this Monday morning. Seated to my left is Cindy Duran, who you'll have a chance to hear from in a few minutes. And the purpose of our visit here this morning, and we appreciate Representative Dalto making the invitation, is to talk to you a little bit about transition from prison, and more specifically to talk to you about the Department of Corrections Children of Incarcerated Parents Project. I'll just start out with a few sort of opening comments, but I think what you'll really find interesting is to hear directly from Cindy. As you know, that the DOC currently houses about 12,700 inmates statewide. About 95% of the people that we currently house will ultimately return back to community. They'll release from prison and transition back to community. Statistically, about 31.2% of our released offenders return to incarceration within 3 years because of new felony convictions.
What percentage again, Dr. Williams?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, it's about 30%, 31%.
31% recidivism,
right.
In 36 months.
Within the three-year period of time, commit a new felony and are returned either to the Department of Corrections or to their counties for local control, offense. What we are attempting to do in the Department of Corrections is to try to focus as much of our resource and energy on effective elements of transition and reentry as we move people back to community. We do try to shape the kind of people offenders will be when they reenter society, and while they're in custody, we work to identify and address the particular risk factors that make individuals a higher risk for future criminal behavior. The goal is to provide the inmates with the skills and resources they need to choose and lead successful lives upon release. So it is that transition and community reintegration that we make efforts on. And we do this in a number of ways. Our alternative incarceration project, the education and workforce development work that we do within the system, the limited drug and alcohol treatment programs that we provide, our cognitive restructuring programs, our efforts of religious services, numerous volunteer programs that occur within the system, victim services, and then finally the issue that we're here to discuss today in some detail, which is the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project. The Children of Incarcerated Parents Project has been an ongoing project for approximately the last 5 years as the initial work group was put together for the Department of Corrections, and in the last a couple of legislative sessions, we've actually passed some legislation specifically related to supporting the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project. The basis comes from really a strong understanding that we have that having a strong family connectivity upon release lessens substantially the likelihood that an individual will reoffend and come back into the system. To give you an idea of the scope of the issue, in 1991 there was about 1 million nationally of children who had parents that were incarcerated. In the last 10 years, that estimate has essentially doubled to where we have now 2 million and I want to make sure I get this right. The number of children whose parents are incarcerated is about 2 million currently. Over 10 million children have a parent who has been in prison at some point in their lives. To give you some Oregon information about that, more than 20,000 children in Oregon currently have a parent in prison. Two-thirds of the inmates that we currently have incarcerated have children that are under the age of 18, and 41% of the children in foster care in Oregon have a parent or a caregiver who is now or was at some point convicted of a felony.
41% of?
41% of our foster care children.
Foster care.
Yeah, have a parent who has a felony conviction. And over half the parents that we have currently incarcerated do expect to return and live with their children upon release. So one of the things we really understand about parenting and about prison is that prison does not stop individuals from being parents. And in fact, there's a fair amount of parenting that continues to occur inside the prison environment in relationships with those children. The issue was, is it the kind of parenting that ultimately we would want to be occurring? And so as a result of that, the department working with a number of our partners has developed a parent education program, which I'll talk about briefly in some more detail. There is no question that there is also a high correlation of future criminal behavior among children whose parents have been incarcerated. It's one of the primary predictors of whether or not someone will, in fact, end up being incarcerated in their life is whether or not a parent was. And so as a result, the idea of breaking the intergenerational cycle of crime is also one of the objectives of this program. Without proper intervention, children of incarcerated parents are many times more likely to someday be incarcerated themselves than their peers. They're at a high risk for school-related problems. They have severe anxiety and depression, and they may expect actually delayed development in behavior and attention disorders, along with the difficulty of developing secure attachments. A number of different things have occurred since the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project work group was organized 5 years ago, and I want you to understand that it's not simply within the walls of the Department of Corrections that this program is having an impact. In fact, the work group and the task force essentially that works on this project has done a number of things with local law enforcement. We found out through research that they've done that 25% of inmates have reported that their children were present at the time of their arrest, and so the impact on those arrests and how to manage that with children is an issue that they've been working on with local law enforcement. We've involved the courts to actually come and see the program and what we're putting on so they can have a better understanding as they make determinations about the determinations of the relationship the parent and the child will have upon release, to know the kind of programs that are available within the system so they can tailor that sentence and those conditions of release appropriately. Likewise, the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute at Portland State University has performed some surveys for local jails to assess what the local jail policy and standards are for dealing with issues involving that large population and the jail population who also have children, obviously, and what those relationships are. So this is not strictly limited to a Department of Corrections effort. We have had, we think, very good success with the parent in the parent education program. It's called Inside Out, and it's an education program which is offered in a 12-week cycle with 36 sessions, and they are essentially a parent training course providing opportunities for growth in parenting knowledge and skill. And the topics range from child development to discipline to transition back to the home. The curriculum was developed in an evidence-based format jointly with the Oregon Social Learning Center and designed specifically to meet the unique needs of parenting effectively from prison. I've actually attended a couple of these parent education classes inside our facilities, and it's a remarkable experience to hear the work that's going on as people are learning in many respects for the first time how to be responsible parents and starting to exercise that responsible parenthood while they're actually still incarcerated. One of the most memorable experiences for me was attending a class with a number of gentlemen at the Oregon State Penitentiary, a number of them who wouldn't be released for quite some time, but were learning how to exercise appropriate parenting skills with their children while they were still incarcerated. The curriculum and the program, in fact, are so innovative that the National Institute of Mental Health has granted a $3.2 million grant to the Oregon Social Learning Center to study the long-term effectiveness of the program. The study began in 2003 and continues through the year 2008. It involves 400 inmates who participated in the program, 200 caregivers of the children who were outside, obviously, the prison system, and the individual children. Other highlights of the program within the prison environment is at our Coffee Creek facility for women. We have a federally funded Head Start program that serves children ages 3 and under whose mothers are incarcerated at Coffee Creek. Those who have met the appropriate qualifications actually can leave the minimum custody facility and go to the Head Start building that's actually on the grounds of Coffee Creek to participate in that program. We, in cooperation with our partner, the Girl Scouts, have a Girl Scouts Behind Bars program. Right now there's more than 130 girls who are the children of mothers who are incarcerated at the facility who are participating in this Girl Scouts Behind Bars program. We have a new Boy Scout troop that's organized at Coffee Creek for mothers of and their sons can also have a similar kind of an experience. There's an Even Start Family Literacy program that's offered through our partnership with Portland Community College and serves mothers and their children. We have modified and reviewed and made changes to our visiting rules in order to allow more opportunities for inmate parents to visit with their children. One of the things that the department has done is attempted to look at all of these processes to figure out where our policies or procedures and we're potentially creating a barrier for successful reintegration back to the family. With other partners, we have distributed 8,000 copies of How to Explain Jail and Prisons to Children, a caregiver's guide to families who are visiting through our visiting rooms, jails, and other organizations. And we have a number of other volunteer projects. Probably the one that you may hear the most about, because they're a terrific partner with us, is the Wilsonville Rotary Club, who puts on an event called Through a Child's Eyes, which is a one-day event that occurs every year at Coffee Creek that, again, is designed to try to reconnect families and children to their incarcerated mother. We have other information about the Oregon Youth Authority. Currently, OYA is piloting the Parenting Inside Out parent education curriculum for young mothers at their Hillcrest facility. What they found was that 19% of the of their population were already parents of one or more children, and these are obviously our juvenile and youthful offenders, and over 20% or almost 20% of them had at least one and maybe more children, and we're starting that parent relationship. There are a number of other efforts that we're making with our county partners in our community corrections environment and various community-based organizations that are also participating at different levels, both in Deschutes County and the Big Brothers Big Sisters program in Portland. Marion and Deschutes County are starting their own Children of Incarcerated Parents programs in their counties to try to meet their specific needs. So that gives you, I think, some sense of what it is that we're trying to accomplish. In 2003, the leadership of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project moved from DOC directly under the auspices of the Children's Justice Alliance, which is a 501c3 corporation tied to the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute of Portland State University. We're actively involved and continue to participate in a lot of ways, but much of the stuff that's expanded outside of just the realm of the Department of Corrections has been a result of the volunteer efforts of those individuals who were involved with the Children's Justice Alliance. One of the recent events that I attended was the recent opening of a Center for Family Success in St. John's area that the Children's Justice Alliance was very actively involved in. They took an old YWCA facility, renovated it. We helped provide some inmate labor. There were a lot of other community partners who participated in it, and it's now a community center tied to a specific community that has a particular problem with how to manage returning offenders back into that community. Along with that, we have transition programs related to children of incarcerated parents as they come back into that community and various other GED and opportunities that are done there. And it's really a great collaborative experience with the Department of Human Services is involved, DOC is involved, the local St. John's community is involved, local county, the Multnomah County folks. And I really believe that it will demonstrate
its... Representative Greenlee.
Does that link with that relief nursery in that district as well?
Yes, it does. Yep. Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenlee, it does. And it is this sort of holistic approach and a recognition that the Department of Corrections in and of itself cannot be the sole provider of service that's going to make someone effectively transition connection back into community. We're a lot about breaking those barriers down, but we're also about building the partnerships with all of the various interest groups that need to provide some resources. So we've done a number of things in our Transitional Services Division to try to deal with those issues, including involving a number of our sister state agencies who own some responsibility and program delivery for the very same kinds of people. And it is that collaboration, that cooperation, and those building of partnerships, both with government partnerships, community partnerships, the private partnerships, the nonprofits, that I ultimately believe will make our efforts surrounding transition successful. As I said before, 95% of everybody we currently incarcerate releases, and about 30% of them return for a felony conviction within 3 years. That cycle, from an expense standpoint, from a long-term controlling the cost of corrections and the growth of the prison population, requires that we do a better job when it comes to reentry and transitioning people in, from community. What I think you have in the conversation you're going to have this morning is one piece of that successful effort, which is the Children of Incarcerated Parents program. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm going to turn the time over now to some comments by Cindy Durbin. Cindy is, Cindy Duran. Cindy has done a tremendous job in sort of making this transition, and I'll give you a little bit of her background to introduce her. She spent 3 years in our facility at Coffee Creek and has successfully beaten a 13-year addiction to methamphetamine. So if you want to get somebody to talk to you a little bit about what drives people on methamphetamine, if you've got those kind of questions, because I know it's an issue that you're all dealing with right now, Cindy might be someone you'd want to talk to. During the time that she was in prison, she took advantage of a number of the opportunities that we offer to improve her life and the lives of her 5 children, who she currently has custody for and is raising now. She will graduate from Chemeketa Community College next term. She's on the dean's list, she is somebody that we're very, very proud of and is one of, I think, many examples of success of people moving through this system. So I've had a chance to hear Cindy on a number of occasions, and I know you're going to enjoy her comments and the very frank conversation that I think the committee can have with her. I'll conclude my remarks here, Mr. Chair, and I unfortunately have another commitment that I need to go to, and I'd ask your permission to be excused, but I'd like to take any questions the committee would have for me directly if you have any.
Well, I do have a question, and listening a little bit about the programs available for incarcerated moms and the excellent work that Claudia is doing over the prison system, I guess my question on a larger scale is, what does the landscape look like for programs and activities for inmates? I know that we've gone through several years here of economic struggles with our budget and cutbacks, and I'm aware that the prison system was not held harmless in those cutbacks, and just want to get a sense of what the landscape looks like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're absolutely right, and it is unfortunately the programs area of our budget that most often ends up falling under the reduction knife. I think that if you were to talk to people, and as you all know, I've been doing this just slightly more than a year now, but if you were to talk to people who've watched over the last 5 or 6 years, they would tell you that our program offerings have diminished substantially. We have a number of programs, and I'm always proud to say, for example, that we have, I think, more than 2,000 individuals who volunteer annually within the prison system to provide programs, including religious services and non-religious related programs. So we do what we can to leverage that experience. But to give you a sense just in the scope of the budget, Mr. Chair, if you took all of the programs that I talked about, alternative incarceration, drug and alcohol, our education programs, our cognitive restructuring programs, you added all of those programs up, including the effort we make with Children of Incarcerated Parents, you put all that money in one pot, it makes up less than 2% of the entire Department of Corrections budget. So we're proud of the efforts that we're making to try to deal with the issues of transition and reentry. We think that we're leveraging the resources that we have about as effectively as we could in the current environment. But there is, without doubt, a need for additional resource if we are really going to be serious about getting ahead of this issue involving transition. A prime example is drug and alcohol treatment. We have about almost 13,000 people incarcerated, 70% of whom have a drug and alcohol addiction-related problem that we have identified at the time through assessment processes at the time of their intake into the system. So that gives you somewhere in the neighborhood of about 8,000 to 9,000 people who have a drug and alcohol treatment need that is at least one of the drivers behind their criminal activity. We currently have 508 beds providing drug and alcohol treatment within the system, and that will reduce under the current budget proposal as a result of reduction. So, and I want to make clear the committee understands, when you come in with a drug and alcohol treatment program or with a problem, you don't sit in, you don't take a drug and alcohol treatment bed for the entire time of your incarceration. So that 508 beds turns over because we try to time the delivery of that treatment to the right time in the person's incarceration plan so that they're getting the most benefit out of the treatment. So those beds do turn over, and so we're getting more than 508 people in a biennium through drug and alcohol treatment. But it is still, if you understand just the dynamics, because those programs, usually the effective ones are intensive, they're at a minimum of 6 months. If you follow that through and you do the math, there's no way we can turn them over fast enough to get everyone who's got a treatment need through one of the beds that we currently have available.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I would like to express gratitude to Director Williams for the great job that's ongoing, and Director Williams, you did touch on that point, which I was anxious to know about, and that is the overall cost of these programs, particularly when you throw in the factor in 2,000 volunteers. But in the process of the last year, is there one part, one place, Max, that you think that we might be able to really make a difference? And I know that a lot of folks say, hey, throw some money on this and this problem goes away eventually. My concern with that approach is that, you know, we need outcomes as opposed to just outputs. We need to have measurable results, and we're seeing some of those. But where is, you're here to tell us today, and I'm anxious to hear from Cindy, but where can we best get the bang for our buck if we had an extra $202 million, just picking a figure out of the air, if we had some extra money, and I'm not $202 million, obviously, that all went by the by. I mean, you'd have thought that we'd have had a 10% or 15% increase in the available resources, looking at the email this weekend as to who all wants it.
Yeah, I already spent it.
But given, you know, Max, tell us a spot for where we could really do some good, and you might just want to throw in something about the Powder River Corrections Facility at the same time. The cognitive sure. Rethinking what's going on there.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Butler and members of the committee, it is a challenge to know, and I want to start out by saying that the department is going through the process mandated by Senate Bill 267 in the last session, where we are evaluating all of our treatment and prevention related programs. In our system, we use the CPAI, which is the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory, which is a national standard that's giving us some indication about where the programs we're currently spending money on are being effective, or where the effectiveness is below a standard that we would be satisfied with, and then trying to target our resources to where we actually are getting the best bang for our buck. I would have to tell you that in the long run, intensive drug and alcohol treatment tied to the cognitive restructuring program, like they deliver at Powder River for the men, like they deliver at Coffee Creek for the women, is, I think, perhaps sort of our best investment. There are lots of other needs that people have, and it's important, I think, to recognize that everyone comes in with a different basket of issues. One of the things we do at the Coffee Creek facility is we put people through an intake assessment process where we attempt to identify the risk factors, essentially, that are going to lead most likely to this person's reoffense or criminality, and then use that to develop a corrections plan. But with so many people having a drug and alcohol-related issue, and that's not to say that you would go and you would open our book and you would look at the drug offenses. The number of drug offenders that I have who have been convicted of drug offense is relatively small as compared to the rest of the system. But what you find out upon doing the assessment is that many of the crimes that were committed as a result of or driven by the addiction, and that that was a substantial factor in leading to the crime. So the effort then is to try to target those resources to address those risk factors. And clearly our cognitive restructuring program with the intensive alcohol and drug treatment is one of our, I think, one of our shining best examples of what we can do. And I think the alternative incarceration program, which operates at the Powder River facility specifically in Baker, is a program where inmates that are identified, the kinds of crimes that can participate are identified in the statute, so it's not everybody who gets to participate. But those who qualify and are moved into that program and they successfully complete the program, they then go out on a 90-day transitional leave where they're under fairly intense supervision and will come back into the system if they violate the terms of that transitional leave. If they successfully complete the program and the 90 days of transitional leave, then they do receive a time cut to their sentence. And our early, and this program has essentially been operating since, it took a while after the session ended last time to get it up and running, but our at least preliminary data suggest to us that it is making a difference, and that even with the sentence reduction, and in fact the sentence reduction operating to some degree as a carrot, is demonstrating some fairly effective results. So both effective in changing a person's life and cost-effective in limiting the amount that the state is expending on these individuals, because obviously they're less expensive on release being even managed at the community level than they are while they're in a prison bed fully incarcerated. So we have a number of, I think, really shining opportunities. And I would tell you that my commitment to the idea of reentry and transition is the real reason that I agreed to accept this position when the governor asked me to do it. It wasn't, although I needed to, it wasn't to go out and build new prisons. There will be no question that that will come and that will have to be part of what we have a conversation about. But the real shining hope in the Department of Corrections, the real opportunity, lies in trying to drive down that 30% recidivism number. And more importantly, reducing the victimization that goes on by innocent Oregonians who were affected by those people who were then victimized by someone that we have already incarcerated for some period of time and release back to the community. It is about controlling that issue. It is about public safety. It's about reducing the number of people in Oregon who are victims of crime. But to do that, we have to make some investment in the very people who are most likely to be the ones out committing that crime and creating those victims. And that's what these programs are generally designed to do. And we're very reflective internally about the impact of the program. We are going through the process as a proponent of Senate Bill 267 when I was sitting in your chair. I now have the non-luxury of being someone having to implement something that I helped pass, but I would tell you that I'm committed to the notion that what we're doing ought to make a difference. It ought to work. We ought to be able to demonstrate to you that it works, and we ought to be able to demonstrate to you that it works in a manner that's cost-effective, and that's a process that we're currently engaged in, and I think we're going to be able to demonstrate over time, both today and hopefully as the program ramps up over time, that all of the program that we're delivering is going to be able to meet that standard and that you're going to be satisfied not just with the outputs but the outcomes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's so important. Obviously, we're always so concerned about our budget and making sure things are cost effective. But I think, Max, that you're the personification of the Department of Corrections. It's not the Department of Corrections, not the Department of Punishment. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate what
you're
doing.
Well, thank you, Representative.
Representative Boone.
I just want to thank you for coming today. I've known Claudia for a while now, and I've just thought this was a perfect venue for her to share this program, and I was really happy to see you too, Max. And I just wanted to say I've been working in some way or another on child abuse and neglect issues since 1978, and so that makes it about 28 years. And I've seen I've come from seeing, being tired of being in treatment only and not putting any money or time into an effort into prevention, and I see how it's kind of, we've had to kind of move backward, but I've seen it from the time I started in it, and people saying you can't prove prevention works, so you have to work with treatment. And now I'm seeing it happen. We're doing both, and this is a big piece of prevention. And then when we get to the point where we can find out all the whys of why people become involved with drugs and alcohol, and mental health issues being a big part of that, and just how people are treated in general, I'm very, very hopeful. And Max is young enough. I hope you're going to spend the next 50 years of your life so we can see this come to fruition.
Mr. Chair, I'll just let that one sit where it is. But I do appreciate the age comment.
Okay, well, I think, okay, Representative.
One question. Mr. Williams, you mentioned 31% return rate. Do you have some strategic things that you've looked at if you continue to go down this avenue with these corrective programs, or what that number would be and what your thought would be for a number that would show us good results? Have you thought that far through it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we have tried to make some effort to draw some pretty broad conclusions about, you know, for every dollar you invest in one of these programs, you know, what the impact would be or what the value would be. It'll be difficult for me to just conjure the numbers up off the top of my head, but I'd be pleased to share with you some of the numbers we have been working with to try to demonstrate what a 1% reduction in recidivism rate over a period of time would actually result in savings with respect to the number of victims, the number of jail beds. One of the challenges with recidivism is a number, and I want to caution the committee in that number, is that it measures a very limited thing. It measures the number of people who have been convicted of a felony within 3 years of release. And so it isn't necessarily a measurement of all of the crime that's potentially occurring, because there is crime that occurs where someone wasn't apprehended. There's crime that occurs where someone was apprehended but ultimately wasn't convicted. So it's not necessarily a total representation of crime. And there's a lot of debate about what the right thing ought to be for recidivism. I think almost every number is in formula is to some degree suspect. But I would tell you the thing to do is to watch, and for us it's the trend. It's to pick the number, and the version we use is one that's used nationally, so we can compare ourselves somewhat to other states on with respect to recidivism. But the idea is to pick whatever the formula for the number is going to be, and then to watch the trend. The trend has been holding pretty steadily at around 30%. At the same time, the prison population has been increasing substantially over the last decade. What we can demonstrate is that for particular groups of inmates, these programs do demonstrate an effectiveness in not returning those individuals back to prison. But as the population has grown, as the number of crimes and the kind of crimes that are being committed within the community, the impact of methamphetamine and some of those other things, I think what you have is sort of this number that stays fairly static, even though with particular inmates participating in particular programming, we can show some fairly substantial impacts with the kind of program. So that's a long way of saying that we'd be happy to get you some additional data and show you what some of those reductions in recidivism. Our target for the benchmark is a 28% number. So our performance measure tied to the Oregon benchmarks is that we would have a 28% recidivism rate. And we're at about 30 now, and the department has pretty much been at about that 30% up or down consistently for probably the last, I'd say, 8 years or so. At the same time, we have not, the Oregon accountability model, our efforts on transition and reentry have really, to a great degree, only started to take solid hold, I think, in probably the last 4 years, which is early to start really figuring out what that impact is going to be. So, and it's a trailing number as well, as you think about the fact that the people we're releasing now won't be caught up in the number essentially effectively until 3 years from now, there's some trailing issues associated with following the data. So, but if you'd like a more thorough conversation about that, Representative Cameron, I'd be pleased to actually welcome and congratulations. We haven't actually had a chance to meet yet, but I'd welcome the opportunity to sit down with you and share a little bit more information about the department. I know as a Salem guy, you've certainly been around the system for a long time, but would be pleased to share with you anything else you have an interest in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, you're the only one who hasn't commented.
Well, I got a question, but I think I have lunch with you today, Mr. Director, so we'll ask him that.
Indeed you do, Representative.
I did want to ask, and you don't have to answer here, but with OLCC talking about enlarging pilot programs to spread their wares further, I would like to hear you weigh in on if that's a good idea or a bad idea somewhere down the line. Maybe not today.
I'd be happy to talk, Representative Anderson, to you either personally or if at some point you want me to on the record about that.
Thank you. Thanks very much, and I think we'll excuse the director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I know that you're going to get a lot more out of Cindy than you did out of me. So.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Duran, and I'm a former inmate at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility and also a recovering methamphetamine addict. I have, on March 8th, I will have 4 years clean. I wasn't always a meth addict. I grew up with my grandmother. I was adopted when I was 4 months old by my grandmother in Mount Angel. I went to high school, was on National Honor Society, Future Business Leaders, played all sports. Upon when I was a junior in high school, I became pregnant with my first son. I still had a year left before my graduation, and fortunately, I had family members who were willing to help with child care so that I could graduate from high school. Upon graduation, I went to work for the Department of Insurance and Finance Workers' Compensation Division. I worked there for, I think, approximately 3 years. During that time, I was introduced to methamphetamine, and I began probably for the first week or so just to use it. I used it on the weekends, and it wasn't even an everyday thing. After about the second week is when I began using daily, and so I was probably addicted within 2 weeks. From there, I think I used for the next 13 years daily there, and I really honestly don't remember a time not using except for maybe during my pregnancy, and even then I actually took methamphetamine into the hospital with me when I gave birth, and immediately as soon as the nurses left, did methamphetamine inside the hospital room right after I gave birth. And that was just, I mean, there was nothing else that I thought about except for getting high. When my first son, Tyler, he was 9 when he decided that things were very chaotic, very crazy. He was pretty much taking care of himself, cooking for himself, getting himself dressed and off to school. So he decided that he was going to go live with his dad, and that's where he stayed until recently. When I first started using meth, I was using meth socially, like I say, and still able to function, still able to hold down a job, and what I felt was keep my life somewhat together. After that, then, it began to be using meth to function at all, to get up in the morning. A few hours later, I would be getting high again. Eventually, it came to where I couldn't sleep unless I got high before I went to sleep. Either that or I would just be up for days. And during this time, I was still able to, I guess, support my habit by any kind of jobs that I held, until eventually I started committing crimes such as identity theft, forgeries, stealing from places where I worked, and eventually started going in and out of jail. I was on the Marion County's top, whatever, most wanted list, I think, 2 times. And methamphetamine just made me do things that I normally wouldn't have done or even thought about. I had no control over things I did and always felt like a paranoia. There was one time when I went to the casino and I had been there for a long time and I had such paranoia that I thought that the security was watching me. I actually went outside and went and bought some hair clippers, shaved my head, and came back in so that I can continue playing because for some reason I thought I was going to be arrested because I had been at the casino too long. So just things, there's just instances like that where you just, it's not, and like I say, things that you would normally do or think, it just takes control of your mind and it causes the chemical imbalances. I started going in and out of jail. The longest I stayed in jail at that point was 42 days. While I was in jail, I did not do any programs, did not go to NA meetings, any church services. I stayed in jail, crying about wanting to see my kids, making bargains with God. If he would just let me out, I wouldn't go back to using meth, and I just wanted to spend my time with my kids. On the day that I was going to be released, I called my grandmother and had her make plans to get my children together. I had 3 children by this time. I had her get the kids together, and we were going to go out to eat and, just spend the day as a family. I was released and went up the street. Within half an hour, I was high again. I got high in the bathroom of a gas station. And while my kids were still waiting at home, it took me 3 days to finally make it back to my kids. So as much, I had good intentions going out, but the meth was still more powerful than I was. Eventually, I was charged with the last arrest. I was in a motel room with my 3.5-year-old, and officers came in, and my 3.5-year-old was sitting on the bed with me. I was doing dope, and when I saw that it was the police, I tried to run. I left my child on the bed and grabbed the dope instead. So I was charged with child neglect, child endangerment, possession of a controlled substance, delivery. Eventually, I was charged with 42 felonies. I was facing 20 to 25 years federal prison, and luckily, I ended up doing getting 3 years at Cotton Creek Correctional Facility. For the first year, I really didn't do any kind of programming. I was pregnant when I went into prison. I was sentenced in July, and I gave birth in September. My son was taken into foster care, and I didn't see him for 15 months. About this time, I started doing programs at Coffee Creek, such as parenting. I did, 90 hours of parenting classes, and then I was doing treatment, cognitive classes, such as Pathfinders and Breaking Barriers. The week before I was going to have a hearing to terminate my rights for the child that I just had in prison, there was a program, Early Head Start, which is kind of out in the parking lot at Coffee Creek. The ladies there came over and talked to me and informed me that I was going to be having a hearing. Did I want them to advocate for me? I didn't know much about the program, but these ladies were willing to go to court for me and let them know that I was in programs, cognitive programs, and a parenting class. At that point, the judge decided that I could have visitation with my son. So the first time that I saw him was at 15 months of the Early Head Start program. While I was at the Early Head Start program, I would stay there. I would go 2 to 3 days a week. My sister would bring up 2 of my kids, actually. And since I had had parenting classes, I was able to interact with my kids, play with them, and discipline them. Even while I had to be, it was really hard having to discipline, not wanting to be the bad guy, even though they had, because it was supposed to be, special visits, but just learning that I could still be a parent. And even though I was inside prison, I also had my son was 15 years old at this time, the oldest one, who had moved out. And during this time, I hadn't had visits with him. He was very upset with me, and I did not make the effort to reach out to him. I felt that if he wanted to see me, he would make that effort himself, until I went to the parenting programs and I learned that it was my responsibility and different ways that I could interact with him. I eventually ended up writing some letters to him, and that's when he decided that he was going to come and visit. So we did have some visits. We started counseling. He actually came inside the prison, and we had family counseling together. About 3 to 6 months before my release, they started working on a transition plan. It was supposed to include my housing and employment leads, where I was going to get clothes, how to get my ID. Well, unfortunately, 2 days before I was going to be released, Marion County's budget was frozen, so I had absolutely nowhere to parole to. When I came out, I had a mentor. She picked me up. We came into Salem and went to an Oxford house. I was supposed to actually go to my PO's parole officer's office. When I got there, they told me that I wasn't going to be assigned a parole officer for 30 days, for me to come back in 30 days. And I had just come from a very structured environment for 3 years, and I let them know that I needed more structure than that. So I told them, you know, I was back on Monday. I was released on a Friday. I told them I'd come back on Monday and then Tuesday and Wednesday, and that's what I did. I couldn't just be let free completely on my own. And so that's what I did. And they wanted me to go stay at a family member's house. And I also told them that that probably wasn't the safest place for me to be, was with family, because they, there was some alcohol use going on. Plus, anything I wanted, they would give me. If I wanted money to go gamble, they would give me that. And the things that they could do were just things that I wasn't able to do. So I went to an Oxford house. I didn't have any money, didn't have a job. The rent was going to be, I think, $325 a month. I interviewed with the president and the vice president, and was able to convince him that I really wanted recovery and that I would do whatever it takes, you know, to get a job and to get on my feet and to be able to pay my rent and be responsible and self-supporting. I went into the Oxford house. I made a goal to be out on my own in 6 months. I ended up getting an apartment in 5 months. During this time, I had visits with my kids. Eventually, in July of last year, I regained custody of my kids. They lived with me. In August, my oldest one came back to live with me. And that's going very well. His attitude has changed a lot. He was having a lot of problems with his dad and with school. He was getting D's and F's on his report cards, and now he's getting A's and B's. He just got a job at Creekside Golf Course. He has a car. I go to Chemeketa, and I'll be getting my associate's degree in June in business administration. I've been on the dean's list for the past 2 terms. Got a full scholarship for spring term. And I'm involved in the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project, and have been invited to speak at, I spoke at the Shoulder to Shoulder Conference for foster parents, and going home for good in Oregon Conference in Bend, and I think I will be working with Pathfinders once I graduate. And I think that's it. So I'll be willing to take any questions if you have any.
Representative Phil May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions, if I may. So, Cindy, how did you live after you got out of prison? You said you went back to the parole officer, and you said you needed more structure. So were you assigned a parole officer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I was assigned a parole officer after 30 days.
So the first 30 days you were on your own without a lot of structure. How did you manage to do well with yourself?
Representative Tomei, I kept myself busy. I had a mentor, and she would take me to where I needed to be, but I was also responsible for, you know, just learning how to ride a bus and going out and looking for work. I found a part-time job as a telemarketer, and I was released in July and then went back to school in September.
And how did you support yourself and your family after you went back to school?
It was just me at that time, so it was a lot easier to support just myself. I was getting financial aid.
From whom? From school? At school?
From school. Okay. I had been told that I didn't qualify for financial aid because I had a drug charge, but since I had completed a drug treatment program, then I did qualify for financial aid. So, and the amount that I was getting was probably just enough to cover myself. So that's what I did during that time.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your children, it sounds like you were using methamphetamine while you were pregnant, for at least some of the pregnancies. So did your children suffer any consequences from that? Did they have any physical manifestations of your drug use?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, my children, one of my boys, Jonathan, he is 7. The only sign that I sometimes notice in him, and I'm not sure whether or not it is related to drug use, is that he walks on his tiptoes quite a bit. And I think that's one of the first warning signs when the child is born, or when they first start walking, is to be on their tiptoes. My daughter, she's 4. She's had 3 heart surgeries, and I'm not sure if that's related to my drug use.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy. You've done a marvelous job. I think we all really admire all that you've done.
Thank you.
It's been a long ways. Thank you.
Here's our camera.
Cindy, thank you so much. I know it took a lot of courage and strength to be here this morning and share your testimony with us. When you came out, you talked about a couple of situations that you were faced with right away, having to go back 2 and 3 times to Marion County, being faced with going back to your family. I'm just curious, it sounds like you had a huge amount of wisdom in making some decisions that in previous situations you didn't go there. Can you just share a little bit more detail about maybe what things transpired in your life that gave you the courage and the wisdom to make those decisions at that particular time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, it was so much different this time. There was a time before when I came out of jail and like I said, just went back to using meth, but I didn't have any tools. I didn't know anything about recovery or addiction at that time. I had just been in county jails without any sort of treatment. And this time, when I got out, I had been through drug treatment, and I understood the way meth affects your brain, that you think differently, act differently, and how to avoid going down that path again. I realized now the consequences that the methamphetamine had on my family, had on myself, not only on their health, my health also as well, and how many lives I had, destroyed, not just my family, but from people who I didn't even know. So, during my drug treatment, we did a lot of role playing. And that, I think, was most important for me because I was able to take different situations. Like, what if I ran into somebody that I knew from my past and they had drugs on them? How was I going to respond to that? And that was one of the first things that happened when I got out. I went, actually, that day to the parole office when I was just released, and I had a mentor meeting to go to where we were told to sit out on the front lawn underneath the trees and wait. Well, it just so happened at that point the person who I had first started using drugs with came walking up the driveway at the parole office, you know, and saw me, and I wasn't sure what to do at that point, you know, and, you know, he started talking to me, and he's like, oh, you know, I just went and checked at the window because I heard you were getting released and this. And right at that point, I made that decision that I'm not going to use, I'm here for a meeting, you know, I just got released. And I knew how to respond to that, to where I can make different choices this time. So I think what helped me most was the drug treatment and role-playing and just learning different tools and using them.
Thank you. Can I follow up on a point that you made? Because I want to understand it a little bit better. So this, you see this person, you're waiting to have your place in line for the meeting. You see a person who you've had those experiences with in the past. And so does that person then sort of automatically offer you drugs, or are you thinking to yourself, this is a person that I could, I mean, in the past, that I could get drugs from, and that I would ask them, or they offer you, because I really have no sort of context about how that works.
Mr. Chair, actually, this situation was just, I knew it coming, I mean, I could see it coming from just from where I was. As soon as he walked up to me and asked me, you know, I just came to the window to see if you're out, and immediately after that, you want to go get high. It was like, I knew what was coming, and that's just, usually, I mean, with that meth addicts, there's not a whole lot of conversation that goes on. It's just, that's what we do, is get high, so it's just unexpected.
So that's kind of the way the conversations kind of go. My other question was, unrelated to that, you were describing a little bit about how you would get resources to be able to buy drugs, and one of them was through identity theft, and, you know, the legislature is... Lots of people are putting a lot of work in on the issue of identity theft. But I don't think anybody really knows what the best possible measure is to take to try to curtail some of the theft. But I wondered if you had any impressions or ideas yourself about things the legislature could do to help protect consumers and help reduce the pervasiveness of identity theft.
Mr. Chair, I think for identity theft to be slowed down, I think there needs to be a lot more security at the banks, ways, in stores, maybe a fingerprinting ID. I know that there's one thrift that's going to be starting, or I think it's thrift that's going to be starting fingerprinting IDs at the store instead of... I think it's just by the driver's license what they have right now. As for myself, with banks, I used to just go into the parking lot at night and follow the cleaning person around when she would dump out the garbage. I would just go get it out and get my information from there. In stores, I knew most of the stores that would require ID or wouldn't require ID, so I think some kind of different security measures there. Through legislation, I know that when I was sentenced, I think it was a mandatory 13 months for each count of identity theft. And now, I mean, I see it in the paper all the time where they just keep on getting probation and just going in and out of jail. So I haven't really thought much about the identity theft anymore. I guess I'm just so busy doing other things that I don't even...
You know, it's a good thing that you're not thinking about it, but no, I just wondered if you had any perspectives, because I hadn't had a chance to talk to anybody about it. Thank you. President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Cindy, very much for sharing this information with us, and we do appreciate your being here. This puts a real name and face on some of the issues that we face, just as opposed to a few million here and a few million there to try and resolve issues. Cindy, it sounds like you had an epiphany underneath the tree when the time came to make a decision. But it sounds like more than that, even when the system failed you, and we went through Mr. Chair, you may remember this last session when the Ways and Means met with other Health and Human Services and other committees, and we had a role play. And Claudia, you'll remember this, when we had a role play and the folks were standing around in room F, and we had a young man representative, somebody coming from the system. And probably the most striking issue, this was Health and Human Services with public safety. Most striking issue was to, as we worked this young man through the system, and we got down to our local governments, seemed like we had all sorts of folks representing the state offices and the various state functions down here, but the place where we'd really cut were the programs locally. And so the local A&D program and the local probation officer and so forth, went, most spots were empty. As a matter of fact, in this role play, the person moved through one of those spots, and then while waiting outside the door of a program which wasn't going to be funded to be able to have some assistance, housing, job, those kind of things, as the young man was standing here waiting for those folks to come back after 6 months, the probation and parole officer came back and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm waiting for them to return so that I can get a job, so I can get some counseling." He said, "You're on the street. You haven't gone back and received the counseling. You haven't got a job. We're taking you back to jail." And went back for another 11 months under Senate Bill 1145 to spend some time in jail because these offices down here were empty. And I think that, in my mind, made the most significant difference. That we had cut these programs down here. We kept these offices full up here, where the water doesn't get to the end of the row up here. Where it does get to the end of the row down here, these positions were all filled. But it sounds like, Cindy, in your case, this mentoring program, when you found these positions empty and unable to get a job and unable to get the more structured probation parole for a period of 30 days, that you had a mentor. Tell us about the mentoring program, if you would, please. I'd like to just know a little bit more about how you learned about that. How soon, while you were on the inside, did you meet your mentor? And what kinds of activities so that you had that support group on the outside when you got out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, my mentor was through Bridgeway, which had a contract with Marion County Parole and Probation to provide mentors for people on parole and probation. She actually came into the prison, I think it was 60 days before I was released. I had the opportunity to speak with her and get to know her. I was able to talk to her on the phone a few times to make plans for my release, where I was going to go, whether I wanted my family to come and pick me up or for her to come and pick me up, what I thought was going to be best. As part of the program, so I came out, like I said, on the first day, she took me to my first NA meeting on the outside, and there's a female mentor and a male mentor. I think now there are a couple of each. And anybody who's on parole and probation can go to the mentoring meetings. They were held at this time once a week out at the jail. There we go to the meetings. We talked about what's going on with us, what's going on with our kids, whether we're having problems finding a job, whether we found a job.
They really cared.
They really cared. And it was about doing activities that were free of drugs and alcohol. I remember the first event that I went to the first social event that I went to was an NA dance. And I had never been to a dance without being high on drugs and alcohol, so I wasn't real sure how much fun that was going to be. But I went, and I actually took my kids with me. It was Halloween night, and we had a great time. And so just learning to do things. We would go bowling. There was a day trip out to the beach. So just learning to do things in the right frame of mind without being under the influence. So I think a mentoring program was just awesome. There was a lot of places in Salem that I needed to be at, but they had moved to different locations. And so she would give me the addresses of where they are now and the phone numbers and just encourage me to make the phone calls. But the thing was that she put that responsibility on me. She didn't go out and make these phone calls for me. I had to do these things for myself, but she was there if I needed support. Taking me to NA meetings because I just wasn't the type of person who was going to go somewhere where I didn't already know people there. And I didn't, when I came out, I didn't know anybody that was in recovery. The only people I knew were the people at the Oxford House who were clean and sober.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to ask her to speak to how she parented before she went to Coffee Creek and how that's changed and what your definition of a good parent was.
Yeah.
That's great.
I never thought that I was a bad parent because of the fact that I had my kids with me all the time. And if I went to go buy drugs, I took my kids with me. If I was doing drugs, I had my kids with me. I wouldn't just go and drop them off somewhere. If I was going to go to the casino for the entire day, I would just put them in that play place that they had there. And, you know, and I felt that other people who didn't have their kids with them, who dropped them off, such as my sister would go out, and she didn't use drugs or alcohol, but it seemed to me that her kids were always at the daycare. And so I thought she was a bad parent because she didn't pay attention to her kids. So it was, I didn't have any type of parenting skills. I didn't know how to cook. My kids just ate Top Ramen. And I didn't know how to play with my kids. My life was about getting high and whether or not my kids got dressed or went to school. That didn't matter to me as long as they were just out of my hair. And so now that I am a parent, I can say that I'm actually a good parent, I get up in the morning, get my kids ready to go to school, and that's like this morning trying to get here at 8, and they had to be at school at 8:30, you know, getting, you know, three little kids ready plus the older one, mm-hmm. making sure that they all get to where they need to be on time, making sure that they have breakfast before they go to school, and just being involved with their activities at night when I do my homework, that's the same time that they do their homework. And I feel like just being a good role model. And when I, you know, they tell me, aren't you going to do your homework, Mom? And even if I don't want to do it, I know that it's our homework time, and that's when we're going to sit down and do it. So being able to play with them, age appropriate. My children's ages, they're 17, 8, 7, 4, and 3. So, like I said, my oldest son came to live with me in August, and so the things that I do with the younger kids aren't age appropriate for him. But me and him just hang out. I go to his basketball games or his sporting events. We go to the mall. You know, I actually went on a date with him and his girlfriend and double dated with them, and it's just we just hang out. But I'm still not only his friend, but I'm also his parent, and he can come to me for advice. I remember a time when I was using that, it was Christmas, and one of my nephews wanted to come stay at my house. And when I asked him, I said, well, why don't you ask your mom? And he said, well, she's going to say no because she says you're bad. And I remember her just looking at me like she didn't know what to say. And that way, he was probably 8 or 9 years old. And now she's the one, she calls me and says, well, Josh and Justin want to go here. What do you think? And I'll, you know, she's like, well, we, you know, they can go, but only if you're going, and things like that. So just to have that trust back for my family and for my kids is just amazing to me. And my parenting skills. Like I said, I did like 90 hours of parenting classes, so I learned a lot from that. And then able to use that, actually use it, instead of just role-playing, was over at the Early Head Start program.
Great. We'll just have a couple more limited questions. We're going to have to wrap this panel up. But Representative Tomei.
I just have two quick ones. What is the Oxford House?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, Oxford House is the transitional housing program.
Okay. Thank you. And it's here in Salem?
Yes.
And the other one is the mentor. Are they volunteers or are they paid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I believe that they're paid through the Bridgeway program.
Bridgeway?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
So drug and alcohol treatment. Representative Anderson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't quite know how to ask this, but do you ever sense among methamphetamine addicts a desire to turn people in who are trying to get you hooked back into the disease? Do folks that have conquered it and are survivors like yourself feel an animosity towards somebody like your friend that came by on first day out, tried to get you back on? Would you have an interest in seeing that they may be reported to authorities or in some way exposed for what they're doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have a problem at all reporting drug activity. I do feel some animosity towards those who I know that are continuously selling drugs and neglecting their kids. And there's times when I feel like, well, if I went to prison, that person needs to go to prison too, and it's just, and it's not fair. But I try to, you know, say, okay, well, I did this and this and this, and it could have been a lot longer time that I got, and I paid my price, and this is, and I have that advantage now of being out and being clean and sober. And I'm sure that everybody will, not everybody will, most people will eventually end up in the system somehow until, you know, because by the time they reach rock bottom, there's a lot of things that are going to catch up with them. I know that one of the things that I've struggled with is housing and not being able to get appropriate housing. I live in a two-bedroom townhouse right now with five kids. So it's really difficult. And I don't, a lot of the people, landlords, don't want to rent to me because I'm an addict or recovering addict and have drug charges. But I just feel that for myself, I think I would be a great neighbor or person to have on my property because I know that the signs of drug use and drug activity going on in the house next door. And like I said, I don't have a problem reporting drug activity. It's just half what I do now. So,
President Boone.
I just have one quick question for you, Cindy, and this is just the medical end of my curiosity, I think. Do you notice any, and you've been sober for, you haven't used for 3 years or whatever, 4 years.
Four years.
2 days. Yeah. Do you notice any physical residue of this, you know, that was quite a long time to use a substance like that. Have you had any that you're aware of now that you're not using that you think, oh, this must be from that or whatever, anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I used for 13 years, and it, I don't think it's like cigarettes where when you stop, things start getting better. It takes a while before the effects, medical effects start taking place. And that for me, now I have asthma. My kids all have asthma, and my teeth, I used to have really nice teeth, and now they're starting to break and chip, and I've asked my dentist, you know, and I told him that I was, you know, a recovering meth addict, and he said it's from that meth use. It just eats through the enamel of your teeth, and I mean, in the back, I hardly have any teeth at all in the back, so it's like there's dental. My memory is awful. I think that was one of the first things that even when I was using meth, I could pick something up and then forget where I put it just right then. And, you know, and it was anything that it was, I would forget where my car was. Things like that. And now my kids joke about it. I mean, they don't know that it's from the meth use, but they'll be like, oh, don't tell mom because she'll forget. Or do you want me to remind you because I'll put my keys down and forget that I just put them down. I'll have them in my hand. You know, I know that goes along with old age, but
you're not old.
I'm not that old, so I'm sure that is from, and the people that I've talked to, even in drug treatment, there was a doctor, and, you know, he said probably would eventually happen or happening now. So it's just this morning I was talking to a friend of mine, and I told him, it's just not fair, the things that I had to do now or suffer from toothache pain because of the meth use that I did before, but it's not always fair, so.
Thank you.
Okay. Claudia, you have a couple of words to wrap this up?
I just want to thank the committee for their kind attention this morning, and I think this is a really critical issue, especially as Max pointed out, with 20,000 children who have a parent in prison, and that doesn't include any who have parents in jail. And I think we're making some important strides, and I am really proud of Cindy for her testimony this morning. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for an interesting presentation. Colleagues, we have three bills we have up today for public hearing and possible work session. We're not going to work any of these bills out today, but we will do the public hearings, and we'll try to do them briefly, say over the next 15 minutes, 5 minutes apiece, if we can keep it to that. So we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 97 and ask Sandy to introduce that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 97 comes to us from the Senate side. With the 25 aye vote, 4 excused votes, this authorizes the State Board of Massage Therapists to, by rule, establish the expiration date of the licensees.
Thank you, Sandy. We'll ask Patrick Allen and Patty Glenn with the Oregon Board of Massage to come forward.
Are they going to give us massages?
Well, you see what happened when the chiropractors came in. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. This, I think, is the third and, I believe, final bill that you'll see of its kind that have to do with moving to birth month licensure for various kinds of professional licenses. It's a best practice the office recommends for professional licensing agencies. You may recall in your consideration of a couple earlier bills a week or two ago, Representative Butler raised some questions having to do with duration of licenses in this context. You'll be happy to know that this board's licenses are, in fact, two-year licenses. Additionally, I've met with Representative Butler and informed him more about House Bill 2094 having to do with extended licensing and talked further about some ideas about how to deal with some of those licensing issues. And with that, in the interest of time, I thought I'd just turn it directly over to Patty.
Thank you, Chair Dolfo, members of the committee. That's it in a nutshell. I don't know that I have much more to add in the essence of time except to answer any questions that you may have. We are looking at a couple of different options for systems, the most favorable being that of a birth month, birth year driven, where someone who was born November of 1967 would review in November of odd numbered years, et cetera. So any questions on behalf of this bill, I would gladly answer them.
All right. Well, I don't know if there's a minimum time limit of things you need to say to be able to, you know, earn our support here. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, may I point out that Patty's been not here tonight?
I'm so sorry.
Suppose we'd ask you to check in for the record.
Thank you, sir. Chair Dalto, members of the committee, Patty Glenn, Executive Director, Oregon Board of Massage Therapists.
Thanks very much.
Did that get us over the minimum number of words?
I don't know. Tell us some more, I think.
Any reason not to run this, Mr. Chair?
We're not running bills out just yet.
Okay.
So thank you very much. If there's nothing further, then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 97. And we will open a public hearing. Should we open these together?
Sure.
Yeah. In the interest of time, we'll open a public hearing together on the next two bills. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 104 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 224. And okay, it looks like we have several people following. Who's the director of the agency?
Linda Russell.
Okay, so we'll call Linda Russell forward, Ernest Wick, and Thomas King.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just like to inform the committee that on Senate Bill 104, it moved off the Senate floor with 22 aye votes, 6 excused. And Senate Bill 224 moved off the Senate floor with the same vote, 22 aye votes and 6 excused.
Oh, actually 8. All right. Linda, we'll ask you to introduce both these measures to us, please.
My name is Linda Russell. I'm the Executive Officer for the Board of Radiologic Technology. With me today, I have Ernest Wick. He's from Pendleton, Oregon. He is our board chair. And we have Thomas King. He is from the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists, which is our professional society in Oregon.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I'll start with Senate Bill 104. This bill basically started out as a concept with our agency to change the language, to clean it up, and during that process, we also took that opportunity to put in specific language that has to do with PET CT and the ability of the requirements for licensure for it. Basically, what I want to point out in this particular bill, so that there is no misunderstanding. We as an agency realize that the American Registry of Radiologic Technology, technologists, excuse me, they are the body that does the certification, has a national examination that is recognized for radiologic technologists. And in our statute, we had referenced that, and then we went into the actual what was required within the education itself. And so what we did is we took the education portion out and just want to emphasize that they must be certified through the American Registry of Radiologic Technology. And I just wanted to point that out so that there wasn't any misunderstanding. We're not trying to take away the requirements for the education portion of our radiologic technologists. And probably the basis of this bill is that in the past, there's new technology out there for PET CT, and I'm going to ask Ernest to kind of give you specifics where this is concerned, because I am not a technologist myself. But the way it currently stands, there is a new piece of equipment that is out there that does CT and nuclear medicine combined into an advanced imaging process. But it currently takes two individuals to operate that equipment. And so what we're asking is that we would like one person to be able to run the equipment. And the person, of course, would have to be qualified. And that's what this bill does spell out. And with that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Ernest, because he can definitely answer any questions you might have where the technical end of it is concerned.
Good morning. I'm Ernest Wick. I'm the chair of the OBRT. And I'm here to answer any questions in regards to PET or CT technology. And as Linda states, currently the way it reads, two different individuals have to run each piece of equipment. So we're looking to have the authority to oversee the individuals who run the machines in conjunction with each other, which will provide a reduction in the cost, hopefully, to patients and healthcare.
Would this reduce the costs associated, or some of the costs associated with some of these procedures?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Why,
Mr. Chair? Well, like I said earlier, what's happening right now is you have to have two individuals, one person to run the CT portion and another person to run the nuclear medicine portion, which is PET. And so by having the rules changed or the law changed, it allows us to oversee one individual operating the equipment instead of two.
Yeah. All right. So you basically have a bill here that allows you a little flexibility to keep up with technology and a little streamlining function to cut some costs in performing some of these procedures. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, Mr. Chair.
All right. Questions or comments from the panel? Representative Boone?
Well, and excuse my ignorance on this issue, too, but how is it now? I mean, now it is, but two people, because they each are certified in their own area, would the person have to become certified in the other area or duly certified, or how does that work?
Representative Boone, Mr. Chair, that's some of the things that the board will have the latitude to work with in regards to the change, and that will allow us to oversee the education, the continuing education, and the performance and criteria of the individuals at the time. Currently, we have a couple of institutions that are going to be implementing PET CT or CT PET combination, and we have institutions that have that in place to where they actually have two people on site actually doing it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Thomas King, and I want to comment is from the society standpoint, it's one of these evolving technologies. It's, and there's other things that are probably coming down the pike we're going to eventually deal with. But for right now, our position, as well as we discussed with our parent organization, the American Society of Radiologic Technologists, which, because this is being dealt across the country, is that as long as the person is certified by the ARRT, American Registry of Radiologic Technologists, they have certain standards that the candidate has to meet before they're even eligible to take the exam. And so if they can pass the exam, be ARRT certified, then it's the ASRT or our parent organization's position is that we don't have a problem with this bill. But we want to stress that there is some accountability for training because NUCMED is a little bit different than producing electrical mechanical radiation.
President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think probably, Ernest, this is for either you or Thomas relative to the really to the technology here. In part, it's like the technology is continuing to evolve, and I'm wondering, and we have a person here who's probably got on a license here that's with us today to use a pan X-ray and those kinds of things in a dental office. Doesn't the board presently have a lot of oversight over those kinds of things without coming to the legislature each time this technology evolves?
Representative Butler, Mr. Chair, currently the way the rule states, you have to be registered ARRT to run a CT scanner. And that's why we're coming forward, because a nuclear medicine technologist cannot run the CT scanner. So in regards to the current situation, that's why we're here. In regards to the PANX or panoramic view that you're talking about in a dental office, I believe that's handled by the dental board
of dentistry.
Board of dentistry.
So that isn't a RadTech issue?
No.
That is correct.
Mr. Chair, let me ask a question about Section 2, if I may, then.
Can I ask Representative Butler, excuse me?
Please, go ahead.
Radiation protection oversees the radiation exposure and the inspection of that equipment in the dental office, in addition to the oversight of the dental board.
So the RadTechs do oversee the machinery?
No. Radiation protection.
Radiation protection.
They're through the Department of Human Services.
Oh, I see.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I believe there's two that the Board of Dental Examiners does do a lot of the training, but in terms of safety and calibration of the machines, that's done by the state radiological safety team.
Okay. And then with regard to Section 2, Mr. Chair, it appears that what we're doing is that we're reducing the options. Presently, it provides a licensure for the rad techs in the diagnostic field, and I assume that that's for both the computed tomography as well as the positron emission tomography. Are currently certified by the ARRT in X-ray technology, or, and now that's being eliminated, have successfully completed a course of study in the approved school of RadTech according to the Board of Radiologic Technology Standards, passed the American Registry of ARRT examination, or the equivalent examination. We're taking that out of the statute so that only the ARRT in X-ray technology, those folks that are certified by the ARRT, will be the only people that are doing this diagnostic work in the future, not those that have been had the ARRT certification or having successfully completed other courses and passed the ARRT examination or equivalent examination.
Representative Butler, Chair Dalto, I can speak to this part of it. What we've done here is we've taken that portion out because it's saying the same thing. If you're certified through the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists, in order to sit for that examination, you must have completed the education through an accredited institution, and in the initial would be a two-year program. And most of the ones that we have here in Oregon get the students ready to sit for the national certification. And so the or and taking that out, we just felt that it would be cleaner if we did. Starting out, we never realized it would ever come to this big thing, but that was our reason behind it. We thought we would be cleaning the language since we were doing it. In our minds, it was redundant, in all honesty, and so that's...
Chair, if I could just follow
that's
up.
That's what happened.
I just would like to know then how many people have completed their, and presently are certified, using the second method, if any, that will be that we're dropping off at this particular point. There's two methods, either the number one, under current law, currently certified ARRT X-ray technology, or the second provides for an equivalent examination. Is there anyone that's certified under an equivalent examination after having completed the course of study?
No.
Okay, that's... Just want to make sure. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it.
All right, thank you. On Senate Bill 224, which is increasing the size of the Board of Radiological Technology and specifying a vice chair position, does that have any sort of cost associated with doing that?
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, how I did this and to come up with it when I sent in my fiscal impact statement was I took all of the charges for my other board members for the biennium, and then I just divided it. And I came up with an approximate cost of $1,500 to add the additional members to our board. But I think the benefits of what it would bring to our board would be so beneficial that I would ask that you would support this bill.
Talk about the benefits, please.
I think the biggest benefit that would come about would be the fact that you would have a diversity of opinion. You would have more input. We each come with different ideas. We each come with different backgrounds. And I think the more that you can encompass and come out with a compromise, that's good thought process. And so that's one big issue. The other would be that we have to have a quorum in order to pass policy set by the board. And because some of our members live in hard-to-get regions of Oregon, for instance, Ernest comes from Pendleton. During the winter months, it's a difficult drive for him to come. With that in mind, if we have one member who's missing, then we won't have a quorum. So the cost of that board meeting would have been kind of wasted in our minds. So we'd like to be able to bring new thought process to the board so that the board can carry out the mission. The board, we had a retreat in January. They've come up with wonderful goals. It's exciting because I've worked for this agency for 6 years, and I have seen such a turnaround and involvement by the members in the attitude change that it's exciting, in all honesty it is. And this would just be an opportunity for us just to keep going on the momentum that we have. And so I would please ask for your support.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I guess it appeared to be somewhat non sequitur to have increasing the size of the board and then being concerned about obtaining a quorum. Does that mean that what you anticipate is that the two additional members will be from the Salem area so that it won't be necessary to cross the mountains?
No, we don't. Representative Butler, we are in Portland. Our membership hopefully will come from all over Oregon. We're not just limiting to the Salem area. That was just an example. It by no means means the whole thing.
Mr. Chair, I must have missed it. The comment was that it was difficult to get a quorum sometimes. What we're doing is we're increasing a quorum from 4 to 5 under this legislation. How does that help us get a quorum unless we bring them from the Portland area, the two new members? How does that assure us that we're going to have a larger number and more easily obtained?
Representative Butler, Chairman Dalto.
Did I misunderstand what you said?
I think that you're making more out of it than it really is. In all honesty, the quorum is just one concern. if you have nine individuals and you only need five, it's just a point of numbers. But what the board is looking at is having more people on the board so that our activities that the different committees work on, that they'll have more individuals with the different ideas and different opinions so that we can grow, so that we can continue to do what they set forth. And that's what this is about. It's an opportunity that the board is bringing to you asking for, because they want to continue with the good things that they're doing now.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Does the board meet, does the board allow telephone or other communication as part of attendance at a board meeting?
Yes, we do.
So that board meetings could be, quorums could be achieved by a call-in for that portion of the meeting that had votes under.
Yes, we do, Representative Butler.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I'm just going to express my concern that this particular legislation provides for the potential of more non-certified members of the RadTech licensees, and the potential of therefore potential of dilution from the five members that are presently required, with the potential of two non-members, that it could be that they would have as many as four non-licensees as members of this board. And I'd just like, I don't know whether which of the two licensees would like to respond to that, whether that would be Monsieur King or Monsieur Wick, but I would like to have someone respond to that issue from the professional licensees. Are you satisfied that your license may be controlled by four people outside of your industry and one member? Because that's all you'd have to have, is the four people who don't have jobs, who don't have real jobs as RadTechs, and one RadTech can make all of your policy decisions in the future.
Representative Butler, Mr. Chair, the intent of the board is to expand the membership of the licensed technologists in the field and expand it to represent areas that we believe in the future need to be represented in regards to PET-CT, nuclear medicine, perhaps ultrasound, and these are some of the things that we're investigating as we move forward into the future in regards to that, as well as looking at having representation for limited license folks.
Mr. Chair, I submit to you that on line 8 there is an error in this bill, and that is that at least 7 members should be licensed practicing RadTechs as opposed to 5, because when you add the 2 in accordance with the request of the board chair, if you add the 2, then you need to add the 2 to your professional licensee if that's what you're after. Is that what you're saying? I thought that's what I heard you say, Ernest, that you felt like that you're going to have more licensees.
That was the intent of our
right, okay.
Forward.
Mr. Chair, there is an error in the bill then on line 8, beg your pardon. It should be 7 as opposed to 5. So if that's your intention. And I fully appreciate your intention, because as you said in your testimony, the whole industry is moving forward very rapidly. That being the case, if it's moving forward rapidly and you want more folks from the areas of technology dealing with the PET and CT, then if you're trying to bring those folks in and help make decisions, this would be the way that you would do it. And that's why I expressed some concern. I know as a holder of professional licenses, those of us who hold the professional licenses would just as soon have other professionals in our industry come and assist us with that.
Representative Butler, Chair Dalto, and the members of the committee, when this concept was born, so to speak, at our board meeting, the idea was to bring an additional public member so that we would have two public members. It's wonderful to have the licensees of a profession make up a board, but it is another thing to monopolize. And it is important to have the public's opinion. We are to protect the public, and therefore their sense of business has oftentimes brings good insight to what's going on in the world around us that we don't often see in state government. We feel that it is a good balance to have another public member. The other position that is listed here, and Ernest is correct when he says that it is intended to be, it's not specified, but it is intended to be held open for the other types of modalities that will come down the road. Charlie Cheek was our legislative counsel. He drafted the bill for us. I guess I just never realized that this would be an issue.
All right. Well, it says at least five members, so I suppose that could be construed to mean seven if you want it to mean, if you decide that you're going to have seven or whatever. I'd ask you to do a little work on this bill sort of offline, and we'll come back and figure this out. Thank you very, very much. We'll excuse this panel, and we'll invite up Susan Putnam and Randy Harp. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning.
If I could have you introduce yourself and proceed, that'd be great.
Hello. Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Susan Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M. I am current president of the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technology. I come in support of both of Senate Bills 224 and 104. 104, given the provision that there will be no verbiage changes as it is written. I talked this morning with our legislative aide at our parent society, the American Society of Radiologic Technologists, and they have no disagreements with any of these bills and advise me on that, so I just came to give my my support to these bills. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair Dalto and committee, my name is Randy Harp, and I am a radiologic technologist at the University of Oregon Student Health Center, and I also am on the legislative committee for the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists, and I'm just here to answer questions you might have. I'm a working technologist, as is Susan, and if there are problems with acronyms that we've thrown out, we're here to assist you in that way too, because we use lots of acronyms, it seems like. Anyway, we're just here to answer questions for you, and we do support this, and we do support them. We think they're doing a great job, and we want to thank you for all the work that you're doing on this too.
Thank you. That's somebody else's committee that's, you know, concerned about acronyms. I think we can keep up. And I saw you, Linda, Susan. I saw you, Susan, in the back. Sorry to keep you waiting. I know that you probably.
Oh, that's all right. I'm very expressive.
I'm glad that you could stick around with us. So I appreciate your perspective, and we'll dismiss this panel. Thank you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 104. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 224. Colleagues, we'll do a little bit more work on those two bills before we bring them back, and we will adjourn this meeting.